Welcome to the Modern Girl Podcast. I'm your host, Caitlin Parsons. I'm a certified holistic health coach, intuitive eating specialist, and health at every size advocate. Cozy up with me each week for empowering conversations with ambitious women as we share real stories around our relationships with food, body, and moving through life in the modern world. Hello. Welcome. Really incredible guest on the show today. I have Stephanie Roth Goldberg with me, and she is amazing. We talk all about how to exercise intuitively, and she specializes in this. Let me tell you a little bit about Stephanie before we jump on in. Stephanie Roth Goldberg, LCSWCEDS, is a psychotherapist, psychoanalyst, and certified intuitive eating counselor with a niche in helping athletes and people struggling with their relationship to exercise. She is the founder of Intuitive Psychotherapy NYC, a small group practice specializing in eating disorders among a variety of diverse populations based in NYC. She herself, as well as her practice, are deeply committed to practicing from a haze anti-diet approach. Stephanie is an endurance athlete and a mother of two young kids. She is a regular guest lecturer at the William Allison White Institute in NYC. This conversation is so juicy and packed full of practical tips and strategies and so many things, as well as a blend of just rich authenticity and Stephanie's personal body image story. Of course, we start out with her first body awareness moment and also how that was a reflection of her sister's body, how this played out in her childhood. From there, we get into three of Stephanie's powerful tips to begin incorporating joyful movement into your life and healing your relationship with exercise, practical concepts to implement into your life while being an athlete and an intuitive eater, strategies to help you reduce shame around movement so that you can start listening to your body, why it's important to feel safe in your body, and practical tips for advocating for yourself in movement classes. All of the things that we stand for here in this podcast community. I know that you're going to love Stephanie. I can't wait for you to meet her. As always, you'll find everything linked in the show notes. This is how you can connect with Stephanie. This is how you can grab all of the things that we have going on in our community. If you have not already downloaded your free intuitive eating workshop, you'll find that there as well. But for now, enjoy this conversation and sending you loads of courage for the week ahead. All right. Stephanie Roth Goldberg. Hello. Welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
Hello. So nice to meet you. This is the first time we are sitting down and getting to know each other. So super grateful you're here and can't wait to get into this conversation. Let's just dive on in. Is that cool?
Yeah, works for me.
Okay. So the first question that we ask every guest that comes on the show is your first body awareness moment. So that first moment where you realized I'm in a body and this means something in the culture that I'm living in, what did that look like for you? How did that impact your relationship with your body image and or food?
Yeah, that's such a good question. It's interesting. I have kind of two thoughts, but I'm going to go with the first time I kind of remember clearly about my body image is is in a bathing suit. I had this bathing suit. I could picture it. It was like a one piece with this weird cutout in the belly. I don't know. I don't think they make those anymore, luckily. but I have an older sister. I have two older siblings. But I have an older sister and she is in a larger body. She always has been in a little bit of a larger body than me or, you know, and I remember that she never wore those suits. And so my first body image moment in some way is a reflection of how my sister's body was treated differently than mine. It was policed a lot more and what she ate, often what she was served at family dinners was different than what my brother and I were served. And so it's interesting to think about that my first body image moment wasn't was actually in the reflection of someone else's body. Like, how come I can wear this suit, but my sister is always in a one piece that my mom makes her wear, a full one piece without the belly cut out. And it's interesting because I talk a lot about this in my practice with people, that often body image is a reflection of what we learn from our caregivers. So as you're asking me this, I'm thinking it's really interesting because it is that I learned through the messaging my mom gave my sister about her body, that my body, I guess in your words, held a higher currency and I had a little more freedom in my body as a being in a smaller body than my sister was.
How old were you?
I'm picturing myself around 6.
Wow. So that's pretty young.
Yeah.
Did you talk about it with your sister or your mom, or did you just internalize it and keep going?
I don't remember at that time, but throughout my life, I talked a lot about to my mom the way she treated my sister. I remember once when I was maybe 12 or 13, I must have been 12. I wrote a fake journal entry and put it near my parents' bedroom, pretending to be my sister, because I always felt bad about how my mom would, I mean, we would eat just a different meal than my sister would eat. And so I remember writing this journal entry, pretending to be my sister, to try and get my mom to be aware of the difference and how it was not okay. That being said, my mom still to this day, she's a lifelong Weight Watchers member, and she's really stuck in that mentality. So, yeah, we talked about it I remember talking about it when I was a bit older, but not quite that young.
This is so interesting. And it's really beautiful just hearing you advocate for your sister at such a young age too. Were you close with her growing up?
I was. We fought a lot. But in the way I think that normal siblings do, because we're about 2.5 years different and my brother, 5 years older. So he and I used to team up on her a lot, but we always were close. And then as adults, we're extremely close, but. Mm-hmm.
So how did all of this impact your relationship with your own body? Were you always in a small body growing up? How did it impact you?
I think it, and at that age, of course, it was unconscious in a way. It allowed, I always have been in a small body, but I think it kind of reinforced this idea that that was a good thing and that was what I needed to hold on to. So I think in the way in which it impacted how I thought about my body is that I understood that I had a higher currency by being in a smaller body. And I had access to things like different clothes and different food. At least that's how I understood it at the time. But that the clothing thing is still true, obviously.
Yeah. And there's some element of safety there, I can imagine. And I'm curious, recognizing that you have this sense of power being in a smaller body and just access to an easier life, it sounds like. Were you using any disordered behaviors with food at that time? Like, what was your relationship with food, or were you just, was this more biological? Were you just naturally in a smaller body and you were kind of capitalizing it in that way, or were you using things to keep you in the smaller body?
Both. I always have been in a naturally smaller body, particularly in comparison, but then very early on, I started using disordered behaviors.
Got it.
So you're right, to hold on to that power.
Yeah. Well, and I can imagine there's a lot of fear with losing that power as well too. So what did your relationship with food look like growing up?
I struggled with an eating disorder pretty young, and on and off, and it took various forms, like I think many people's do. whether it was, you know, binging, I struggled with bulimia for some time. And then when I was an older teen, it really did take this form of a little bit more restriction. I ran track in high school, for some of high school too. So in some ways that sort of performance mindset was there, mm-hmm. Too, of kind of restricting, but eating to, you know, keep up on these runs or whatever. It's probably why I was never a great athlete then, because I was quite underfed. And then, you know, in my early 20s, I also went to Weight Watchers for some time. I think because that was what I knew and I wanted to maintain my thinness. And so I tracked food for a long time. And then I went into bodybuilding very temporarily. And that was also quite a disordered mm-hmm. world, right? Steamed chicken and broccoli for, I don't know, maybe a year. And that was like all I ate, and some protein shakes.
Yum.
So I think it's, yeah. there's this picture of me at my sister-in-law's 25th birthday, and everyone has mimosas and I have a protein shake. Mm-hmm. And that was my early 20s in some ways. So
interesting. Yeah. So how did you major in nutrition in college?
I didn't. I majored in criminal justice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. My graduate degree is in social work. And that took form in the social justice way, which is still part of my practice. But, I thought I was going to work in the criminal justice world, maybe law school or, something like that. But mm-hmm. then I went to social work school.
Interesting. So what was your relationship like with food and your body moving out of college and moving into, graduate school, a career, all of these things? And also, I know you mentioned you had disordered eating and specifically eating disorders. Did you ever get treatment for that? Or what was the path of recovery like for you?
I did get treatment when I was quite young, like twice, actually. Once when I was before I went to college, and then after college. But it's interesting because I've always been an athlete in some form. And so the path to healing, which is not a typical story, took form in wanting to be a little more competitive in running specifically. And I was struggling with a lot of bone density issues and fractures. And I sought help specifically for the medical issues that I thought were going on. And it turned out I was suffering from the female athlete triad. I wasn't menstruating, and it was really my love of sport that got me to heal my relationship with food so that I could continue competing the way that I wanted to.
What did you love about it? What did you love about competing? I think that's really interesting and also really beautiful that you were able to name that authentic love for the sport versus doing the sport to manipulate your body. So what did you love about it so much?
I really loved the community. I will say that I was always part of a, you know, running's a pretty individual sport, but I was always part of a team. And I really loved, like, we would meet in Central Park at 5:30 in the morning. And I really loved having friends at that time, and we'd go get coffee and then we'd go to work. And it was like such a nice way to start my day. And I really liked it felt really empowering for me to run. I think particularly because it was a sport that you're kind of competing against yourself in most aspects. And so it didn't feel as though it had that competitive nature that I felt a little bit when I was younger. And I tried cheerleading and those kinds of things, which never stuck for me. So I really liked that it was, you know, it really felt more, there was more camaraderie. And it really felt like that was my whole community at that time too. And I loved feeling powerful in my body, which is something I didn't feel through years of an eating disorder.
You know, what's so interesting, Stephanie, I totally resonate with that. I am very like averse to competition in general. And I think that it's really interesting that you identified this being a self-competitive sport where you're competing against yourself. And one of the things that's interesting to me about that is the competition that goes on with eating disorders and disordered eating and the parallels between just that natural desire, or aversion perhaps, you know, to compete with others and just compete with yourself instead. Have you like found parallels in your own life with that? Or I'm sure certainly clients and things, but does that question make sense?
I kind of somewhat, but see, can you ask me again?
Well, was it even really a question? I don't know. I guess I'm more or less expressing that the interest in the parallels of disordered eating and eating disorders with that self-competition and how so many individuals who struggle with disordered eating and eating disorders tend to shy away from just competition with others and choose sports that are more self-competing. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. Yes. I think that's an interesting parallel. You're right. And I think, you know, it's interesting. So my practice, I work with a lot of athletes, and many come to me because they're suffering with eating disorders or disordered eating and want to work in their sport. And some are competing against others if they're depending on the level of competition. But it's interesting because one of the things we do work on is not comparing, you know, what someone else's workout was or what someone else is eating. So it's an interesting parallel for sure now that you bring it up.
Well, before we get into your work, because I have so many questions around how you support clients and just the work that you do, how did you begin to find your own healing and your first introduction to intuitive eating? What did that look like for you?
It's interesting. I would say I was definitely quite far and into eating disorder recovery well before I found intuitive eating. I think intuitive eating freed up some of the fitness fueling, quote unquote, that I was doing. So sort of my recovery story is that I spent a year doing bodybuilding, which was really, really toxic. And actually how I ended that year was that I really wanted to do a century bike ride around Lake Tahoe that my sister had done the year before, actually. And there was no way to do both. There was no way to eat as little fuel and do what was required of bodybuilding. And I kind of left that whole culture because I really just had my eyes set on going to Lake Tahoe with a bike. And I was working with a dietitian at the time, and I did have to, you know, sort of kind of reintroduce myself to eating out and doing all these things because my food was so controlled. And in some ways it feels as though it naturally happened. It was just this big sigh of relief of being able to eat at a restaurant and eat food with flavor and stop carrying around powdered drinks. And it was years later that I found intuitive eating, and I've told this story a few times. I was training for an Ironman, and a patient of mine had canceled, and I had the intuitive eating book on my bookshelf in my office for years. It was I have a lot of books on my bookshelf that I've never opened. And I was laying on my couch, as I sometimes do when people cancel, and just kind of relaxing, and the book caught my eye and I opened it, and it just resonated. I don't know if it was the time, if it was the place. And I remember I took the book home, and then I was like, oh, I'm going to have to buy a copy for my home, 'cause I like, now that I've read this, I want to leave it in my office on my bookshelf. And I mentioned it to my coach and I said, you know, how do I don't know if I could really do this at the level of sport that I'm doing at the moment, but what it did free me up from in some ways, I remember specifically being on a bike ride and going, I am hungry right now. I don't know why I'm waiting till this prescribed time to eat, when if I feel hungry, it's because I'm probably slowing down and I feel a little sluggish. And I remember I ate at that time, it was a gel, sooner than the timer I had set to go off. And I felt instantly better. I was like, oh, look at that. I actually paid attention to what I was feeling in my body and then tended to it. And I feel fine. And so again, it was kind of, it was like that last step that I needed to bring real awareness to my body, during movement particularly. So yeah.
That's so cool. I mean, I can just see this story coming to life and it's so beautiful. So how did you begin integrating intuitive eating into your practice? Were you, I know you're a therapist also, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
So were you introducing this with clients? Did you go back to do your intuitive eating certification to become a counselor? What was the process like for you?
So I'm a licensed social worker. So the intuitive eating counseling is an interesting thing. But so I did have a practice where I specialize in eating disorders, and I was already working with athletes because that was my community. And I knew so many doctors and PTs. And in 2017, I started my intuitive eating certification because I wanted to learn a little more about it. As a therapist, I will say I usually defer to dietitians to do the real heart of intuitive eating counseling, because it is, while that's a certification, it's out of my scope of practice for my license. And there's so many fantastic dietitians that I work with who are intuitive eating certified as well. But what it allowed me to do is introduce some of the concepts like diet mentality and give them a framework that then you could say to someone, hey, why don't you order this book? We can go through it together and we can talk about it and we'd have a shared language. And that's really the way in which I began incorporating it, because I am a psychotherapist and a psychoanalyst, I don't do some of the real like talking about food necessarily with clients, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. It's really the relationship to food.
Yeah. Which is so important. And you work with only athletes, or is that just a large majority of your practice?
That's a good majority of my practice. No, I work with, I would say almost exclusively, disordered eating and eating disorders. And then some people are athletes and some are not.
Okay. Well, I know that a big piece of just your passion for this work is having conversations around how to introduce intuitive eating, and intuitive movement to people who are athletes or who have more of an active life, and just breaking down the stigma that you can't be an intuitive eater and an athlete or a high performing athlete and all of these things. And so what were some of the patterns that you were beginning to see in the intuitive eating space, or just questions from your own clients who were high performing athletes? Where was some of the disconnect that you felt like gave you access to be able to talk about this in a completely different way?
What's really interesting is eating disorder treatment until very recently you weren't allowed to move if you went to eating disorder treatment. It wasn't something that was integrated. So movement was taken off the table. And so even the people who I work with, who I would say are not athletes at this point, a lot of people like exercise, right? So what I began to notice was this pattern of people who were getting treated for eating disorders or trying to heal their relationship with food, and no one was talking about movement. And then it was really confusing for people. Can I do this and still enjoy exercise? Or, you know, there's one eating disorder center, McCallum Place, where I've sent, when I work with people who need a higher level of care, athletes, because that's what they do. That's where they specialize and it's excellent. But because I have that model and I've worked with people there, I think, why doesn't everyone who's receiving some kind of eating disorder treatment or even just, you know, outpatient in an office also learn about movement and how to integrate safe exercise? Mm-hmm. Because people would come to me and go, my last therapist or my dietitian says, I can't exercise at all. Which felt really unnatural for most people. And similar to if you restrict food, what I often was seeing too is people were quote unquote binging. So they would not exercise and then decide, okay, I'm not going to exercise, but I'm going to walk absolutely everywhere and never, and I'm not going to count that as exercise because maybe I'm not changing my outfit and going into a fitness studio. But it was this idea. And then it became kind of secretive. I was noticing with a lot of my clients that, idea. And so I thought, wow, no one's talking about how to have a healthy or intuitive relationship with movement. And so people were kind of almost feeling as if it was some like a bad word that like, oh, I'm healing my relationship with food, but that means I can't exercise.
Mm-hmm. Well, so where do you feel, and I'm curious from just your personal and your professional opinion, but I love what you just said about this restriction aspect and how restriction almost always leads to binging in so many different areas of life. I mean, obviously food, but to your point, movement, you know, anything that we restrict, whether it's a TV show, whether it's people that we love, whether it's words that we want to say that we're not expressing, right? It always seems to surface in this like boomerang effect, right? So what's the process that you take clients through to begin introducing a balanced, joyful, just peaceful relationship with movement that doesn't feel restrictive and or forced, and it really just is more natural?
So similar, and you know, when we go through the intuitive eating steps, right, ditch the diet mentality and or reject the diet mentality is one of them. I think we have to apply that to exercise, like the idea that you're not exercising to not so that you can eat dinner later or because you ate something that you felt, you know, so I think you have to first work on that connection that people make and divorce those two things, that exercise sort of as punishment and exercise as either earning food or burning food. And that's one of the first things. And sometimes that does mean that someone can't participate in movement to start, because a lot of times people are in the habit, oh, I just go to this exercise class every day. But if you don't take a break from that, you might not realize, do you like that? Is that, what's your motivation? So a lot of it starts with the thoughts, kind of catching why you are doing certain things, and slowing down so you can feel how you feel in your body. Similar again to the intuitive eating model of, am I hungry? Am I full? Really tuning in and having that awareness. It's, do I want to move my body and how do I want to move my body? Do I need rest? Is that okay to take? And so sometimes I will have people journal about that to start, sort of, can you think about, pay attention to why you might want to participate in that movement right now? And how does it make you feel during, or what are you thinking about during that movement?
Mm-hmm. I love the idea of journaling with this. I mean, I'm a big believer in journaling in general, but one of the things that I think is really interesting when it comes to movement is I think we just live in this culture where we're so used to routine and quick fixes and just finding something that works and just assuming that that's going to work forever, right? In terms of the joy that we feel with that. So, and I've certainly caught myself in this as well too, because decision fatigue is real too, right? But
right.
What I'm curious about is breaking down intuitive movement in a way that gives people access to a variety of movements without creating that decision fatigue. So I think journaling is a really, really brilliant opportunity to begin doing this. Do you have any other ways that somebody might be able to just tune into their own intuitive movement that feels good without feeling totally overwhelmed?
Yeah. So one thing I do, this is a kind of like a journal prompt too, but as I do, and this is common in eating disorder treatment too, sort of the red, yellow light system. So I have people think about what exercise makes them feel guilt or shame if they miss it, or can they do modifications, or do they push themselves really hard, or they feel unsafe in those spaces? And that would be, let's call it a red light. And then a yellow light is one you're kind of feeling out. You're not sure you like it. Can you make a list of those movements and try them out? And then green light is usually something that people feel really comfortable with. It's not necessarily attached to changing their body in any way. And it's safe. They have found a safe relationship with it. And so you could start by doing those quote unquote green light movements. The other thing that's really important here is having a way to embody yourself before, like, so that you're aware of how you feel in your body during each exercise.
I love that.
Yeah. Cause as you're saying, there's like this idea that we just kind of go do things on routine. And so oftentimes we don't even know how we feel in our body while we're doing them or if they feel good. But so there is a way in which there's a practice of kind of grounding yourself before you go into movement, feeling your feet on the floor, feeling all, you know, sort of your muscles tuning into them and doing a little bit of, I always encourage people to do kind of a slow warm up or wake up of their body and muscles so that they're in tune with how they feel.
I love that. That's brilliant. And it's so powerful and so counterintuitive almost, right? Based on the culture that we're living in, we are just not taught how to pause and really listen to our body and reflect. And we're really not taught how to feel embodied. And so that's such a beautiful entry point that I think so many people can listen to and use right now, wherever they're at in their life. So thank you for that. So I want to pivot the conversation a bit because we were chatting before we hit record. And one of the things that I'm interested in talking about is the idea of forms of movement having recovered or having become an intuitive eater and going through this process and just the stigma that's attached to certain forms of movement and the shame that's created in the intuitive eating culture per se. And some of the secrecy and shame and judgment that so many people experience. We've got a wide variety of people at all different stages of their relationship with food and their body in this community. And so for those people who might be embodying more of the intuitive eating lifestyle and done the work to heal their relationship with food, and their bodies and are really just moving in that direction, and they're starting to feel some of this discomfort around the forms of movement that might have been disordered before, but now are beginning to feel more joyful around it now. How do you navigate that? And I think that this is your area of expertise as well too. So just this whole conversation, how do you begin to navigate it?
Yeah, it's so interesting because, you know, as certified intuitive eating counselors, and we have, and this is how we connected, right? This Facebook group. And so often there's so many questions. I don't know if you've seen these, right? Like, I have an athlete. I don't know what to do with it. Or I'm working with someone who really goes on long hikes and that's what they love to do. Is that okay? Or, you know, and it's interesting because I feel as though no one knows what to do, how to incorporate this intuitive eating model with people who really either are more competitive or move their bodies more. And I think one thing that doesn't happen a lot is making it known that you have permission to do that. You can be an athlete and be an intuitive eater. And you can, you know, have goals around exercise and still be an intuitive eater.
Mm-hmm.
I don't.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No. Well, my question to that is, how do you do that for anybody who's listening, who's like, I want to be an athlete and an intuitive eater. What are some things to either begin looking out for and just, you know, keeping a pulse on in your relationship with food and your body and movement? And how do you begin to integrate some of these concepts that you're talking about as it relates to athletes or just people who like to move their body more?
Yeah. So I think, again, the number one thing to look out for is, would you participate in this movement if it didn't change your body?
Ooh, and if that's such a good question.
Yeah. Cause if you answer no, that's not intuitive movement.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's also a great framework to begin with. And for people, it's different kind of. So for people in sport, I think, you know, and this is beginning to happen a little bit, but also recognizing that if you can track your performance, not necessarily your calories, you will learn what works for you. We can't deny that more high performing competitive athletes do need a certain level of a structured meal plan around competitions, right? I recently did a supervision with Evelyn around this because I'm working with someone who is going through an Olympic trial. And of course they can't totally listen to their hunger fullness. You know, there's a lot of things they need to do to perform. Mm-hmm. But one of the, and I work with their coach as well and their dietitian, but one of the things we talk about a lot is tracking your performance and how you feel by eating different foods and what your body might be craving.
Mm-hmm.
And how does it feel if you give your body those things? You know, if you're craving something really salty after a workout, that's your body telling you something. And often if we listen to that, we could say, oh, I probably need more salt intake, more sodium during my workout.
Yeah.
If we tune into that. So I think intuitive eating for athletes in some ways does look a little different because there is a little more tuning into, okay, what's my body telling me? And there's a little bit more of prescriptive eating, but that's true. Someone who posted about that, you know, hiker, that's true too. They will need some food along the way. But another thing that happens with intuitive eating, I'm sure you've seen this, is people really think of it as hunger and fullness, which it's not. It's nourishment. We have to take care of our bodies. So in the same way, if I know I'm not going to be able to eat for 6 hours because I have work or whatever, I will eat something or I'll make something quick to bring with me. And even if I'm not hungry, I will eat it. So I'm not super hungry and cranky later. And that's one of the ways we have to also treat this with exercise and intuitive eating is tuning in and nourishing our bodies in that way that we might not be in touch with our hunger or we might not be hungry at a time that we can eat, but we do need to eat.
Mm-hmm. This is one of my favorite concepts to talk about with clients, actually. Nourishment is self-care. And, you know, I actually don't work with that many athletes. But I do work with a lot of people who are very high performers in their jobs. And so what that looks like in my line of work is somebody who might be back to back to back to back with meetings all day. And similar to what you're expressing with, you know, a high performance or just a very long window of training or whatnot, you might not be hungry before you start those meetings or you start those trainings, but nourishing your body from the perspective of self-care and knowing that you need that fuel to get you through your day in a sustainable way is so important. And it's also very attuned also, right?
Right.
It's so hard though, because we're not taught that in our culture. We're taught how to time when to eat the snack or the goo pack for the athletes, right? And how to actually eat by the clock versus listening to our bodies and learning what works best. And I love the example that you gave too about cravings that come up with the athletes that you work with, and just acknowledging if you're craving salt, using that as an opportunity to ask yourself what this means versus looking at it as a problem.
Right. And I think what you're saying is really interesting too, because I also work with people around this during the day, right? If you have a lot of meetings, you still need to eat. But I think the other thing that goes on in our culture is that people just really think of intuitive eating as a hunger fullness sort of quote unquote diet. And then there's not enough education or there's not enough people talking about that sort of as, you know, nourishment is self-care aspect of intuitive eating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely been co-opted to the hunger fullness diet.
Yes.
Which, you know, I think diet culture will get its hands on anything that it can to make a buck. So I think that it makes sense, unfortunately, and very sadly, because it's quite the opposite of that. You know, one of the most beautiful parts about intuitive eating, I think, is it's so much more than hunger and fullness, right? Like, yeah. I mean,
yes.
Self-care is a main, like, that's the hub of intuitive eating and just the nuances of self-care. I love that satisfaction is such a beautiful part of intuitive eating. I was actually just talking to a client about this before we started recording. We're talking about celebration and play and how to integrate reward in really creative ways that feel good and authentic for them versus just more prescriptive ways, right? Whether, you know, I think it's interesting, and I'd be curious because you work with a very performative group, it sounds like, where, you know, there is reward based on winning something or achieving something, right? But we're in this culture where it's taught to us that, well, when we win something, we get food. And there's nothing wrong with that. Food is a part of the celebration. It's a part of this beautiful relationship with how we celebrate reward and all of these things. But there are so many other things to satisfy us as well, too, in terms of achievements and success and celebrating and reward and all of these things. And so I love that aspect of intuitive eating in that it's so much more than just food alone.
Right. Absolutely. Right. 100%. And that's the other way in which, again, like movement can be part of that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, absolutely. And it's one of the principles of intuitive eating also, which is, it's so important. I'm curious what you feel like professionally speaking and doing this work, why is movement so important? I love what you commented on before, just recognizing that people were really feeling this deficit, just like they would if they were restricting any type of food. But why is it so important, just generally speaking, for people to move their bodies?
So one thing I will say is, as a health at every size advocate and psychotherapist, you know, we don't have to move our bodies if it doesn't feel good. Movement's not required. And that's another thing that happens in the culture, right? Is there's all this shame if you don't move your body. And so we have to kind of undo that too, in order to find joyful movement, right? In order to find intuitive movement, is if you can reduce the shame around the fact that maybe you really don't like to do yoga, or maybe you really don't like to run. That's okay. There's no one saying you have to do that. But I think where movement becomes important is there is a ton of research, right, that shows movement and exercise does help reduce anxiety and depression. There are clear links to that. There's clear links to helping with bone density, which for people who have suffered from anorexia, bone density is often something they may struggle with. Mm-hmm. And so strength training is shown to help your bones. So there's so many reasons where movement is important that have nothing to do with changing your body. As a mom, I love being able to chase after my kids. My older child started riding a bike recently, and I love running alongside him and being able to do those kinds of things. And that has nothing to do with changing my body, right? So there's movement for those functional reasons as well. Mm-hmm. And also something that's interesting is, you know, serotonin is produced in our guts, and people who have struggled from disordered eating and, you know, severe eating disorders, often their stomach requires a lot of healing and they may not have a lot of serotonin. Mm-hmm. And so if you can change some of the brain chemistry you have, that's helpful. Endorphins are helpful. So there's so many reasons where movement is important, but if we create shame around it and guilt, we take away all of those benefits. Because mm-hmm. no matter what endorphins you have running through your body, if you're going, oh, I didn't do this good enough, or I should have done this, or I need to do that, your thoughts have outruled any benefit.
Yeah. Well, that energy, that like energetic bank account in our minds and that preoccupation, God, thank you for sharing that. That's so important. And also to your point that even if we have that mental preoccupation and guilt and shame around resting is so yes. important. And I honestly think that it kind of goes both ways. I feel like we have one side saying, you know, feeling bad about moving the wrong way or not enough, and then the other side feeling bad about not moving at all and thinking that they should move more. And the reality is, I think that to your point, if we just go back to how much are we thinking about it in general versus just taking care of our bodies intuitively, whether that's moving or resting, and the intention behind movement or rest, it really changes everything.
Yeah. And you make such a good point about rest too, because that does have to be part of every kind of more intensive movement plan, so to speak. Mm-hmm.
So I feel like I can have this conversation with you because you're also a health at every size advocate, and I would love to get your professional perspective with this as it relates to movement. But do you support clients who are in larger bodies in your practice?
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
So can you share, and also just from a, we can zoom the lens out on this, but one of the things that I have conversations about often with clients of mine is the discomfort that people feel being in a larger body and moving their bodies, and this cultural messaging around you can't move if you are in a larger body, or there is that discomfort, or you're limited in terms of how you are able to move and the comfort that you're able to feel. And that really roadblocking people from feeling accepted in terms of moving their bodies or feeling able to move their bodies if it's accessible to them, if they're in an enabled body who can move. And this really, you know, even being in a wheelchair, there's different forms of ability and movement and all of these things, right? So meeting people where they're at. But how do you navigate that with clients who are in a larger body, or through treatment even might be, their bodies might be changing and just navigating those changes with movement and some of those beliefs physically, mentally, and emotionally?
So I think it's interesting. One of the staples of all of this is that embodiment piece. So we have to be in our bodies to feel safe. And that can be really hard for people who are in marginalized bodies, because it hasn't always felt safe to be in their body. Their bodies have been maybe a source of ridicule, or people don't accommodate for them. And so one of the main things to begin with is allowing someone to feel safe in their body so that they can begin to recognize where they feel safe and where they don't. Mm. And you know, luckily we're in a time where there are resources of people who are exercise professionals who work with people in all different kinds of bodies and advertise that. And so there are some resources of here's where you can go and feel safe to start out with and maybe gain some confidence in moving your body. And I think we also have to recognize, you know, as I said, I'm in a smaller body and I always recognize with people and make sure they feel comfortable having these conversations with me. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's important to acknowledge as well. And acknowledging that as people who are in smaller bodies, one of the best things we can do in sort of the exercise fitness world is advocate when we hear fitness instructors and things like that making comments about people in larger bodies or, you know, making it about weight loss, because that may feel unsafe to someone in anybody, but particularly in a larger body, or pointing out when facilities don't have accommodations for different bodies. I think one of the benefits, one of the sort of interesting things that's happened during the pandemic is that people have had all different access to moving their bodies at home, which is a really safe place to do that. And so I encourage people to experiment, see what feels good, see, you know, also give permission that you can leave any exercise class at any time. You are not mandated to stay. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really important thing for people to own. And you can ask in the beginning for the teacher, if it's a, you know, that kind of thing, to give modifications and allow for that.
Yeah, this is great. I just love your passion for advocating for yourself at all different stages. I mean, just that's so important. And, you know, whether that's moving your body, not moving your body, how you move your body, where you move your body, just really advocating for yourself and listening to yourself and giving yourself the permission to meet your needs in a way that feels powerful for you. And this idea of embodiment that you keep coming back to, it's so rich.
Yeah. Yeah. Embodiment's really an important part of all of this. I mean, in some ways, how could we be intuitive eaters if we're not embodied? We wouldn't know what we're feeling in our body.
Yeah. Okay. So how do you, I'm curious about your own personal embodiment practice, especially with kids, especially in a pandemic with a thriving practice, all of these things. When you have those days when you're just thinking something's off, I need to get back into my body. I need to get back in touch with myself. What are some tools that you always use to begin your own personal embodiment?
Yeah, I always do a body scan. I usually do a body scan in bed before I get out. And then again, once I'm vertical and have had some fluids, I'm an early morning. I wake up early morning. So I always do a body scan. So if I'm going to go for a run, let's say, I will do it outside. I'll get ready. I'll go outside. I'll have my feet on the ground. It's almost as if you're checking the weather, right? Like, is it going to rain? Do I need a long sleeve shirt? What's going on? And I start from my feet. My feet are on the ground. How do my feet feel? Wiggle your toes. I've had a lot of foot injuries. So I also, you know, that's an important place for me to start and move up through my body and just make sure I feel okay. And for me, a good part of embodying movement too, this is not true of everyone, but I like to know a plan. What is my plan? Where am I going? Can I picture myself moving through it? Does that still feel like a good thing for me to do today? And I keep a training journal, which a lot of that is, to sort of track how is my energy, what's going on, what are my goals? But it's also a good way to say, okay, I took care of my body today. My foot started hurting and I turned around and I came home, or I took care of my body, that even though I felt as though I had a lot of extra energy, I stuck to my plan and I didn't push myself too hard. So yeah, I think a lot of it starts with just a body scan and sort of scanning your surroundings and kind of like any other grounding technique.
Mm-hmm. It's fabulous. And I think that that can be applied to so many parts of life and our days, even beyond movement, right? Just like getting back to that practice of grounding and centering and checking in with how we're feeling from head to toe.
Yeah. And the other thing I will say, and you and I talked about this a little in the beginning, is it's okay to have an exercise plan or a goal, right? Like that's another thing I think intuitive eating people I've seen a lot get wrong. Like it's not intuitive if you have a plan, which really is something that grinds my gears. Because as you said, as a mom, as someone who works full time, like I have a lot going on. If I didn't plan anything, it wouldn't happen. And so that's okay. It's also just having the flexibility. And this happened last week. I thought it was really funny. My partner, we alternate days, which one of us gets up really early, got up and I didn't, you know, I don't notice whatever. And then all of a sudden it was sort of time for breakfast. I'm like, what's going on? What are they doing? So I go downstairs and they had taken a blanket and a pillow and fallen asleep in like our makeshift gym. I go, well, what are you doing? And he said, well, I'm tired, but I still wanted to claim my time. So, so it was like asleep on the floor, which was really funny to me, but it was this perfect intuitive moment of he took his plan. He wasn't on sort of the early morning childcare shift, but he knew he needed rest. So he took a blanket and pillow downstairs and he took a nap.
That's so fabulous.
Yeah. Which I thought was great.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love this topic too. And I'm really passionate about this as well. I think that plans can serve such a beautiful purpose in people's days, and similar to movement and really rigid, restrictive, just disordered movement, it's a part of our relationship with food and ourselves that we also have to heal and be more intentional with. And I think that I love what you're saying about planning movement to really just take a practical approach to taking care of yourself, almost that nourishment of self-care perspective, given the circumstances of a given day, right? Especially if you're busier, and just having that flexible plan, like you said. I think it goes hand in hand with how we nourish ourselves with food, right? There are so many beautiful opportunities to, you know, not necessarily meal plan and spend hours in the kitchen and you know, eat the same thing every single day. That's not really where I come from with this, but having some sense of structure or a plan on really busy weeks, almost as if you were packing your kids lunch for them to go to school and like packing them a snack. And I use kid examples a lot with my adult clients because I think kids are such a fabulous way that we can learn about intuitive eating and just our intuitive relationship with our bodies. But you know, a kid is busy. They're at school. They're not gonna have time to like stop and make their lunch, right? And at the same time, when they get to lunch, sometimes they trade with other kids and sometimes they are hungrier or less hungry. And there's just more of that flexibility around the plan. And I think that we can all use that in ways that are in alignment with busier schedules sometimes too.
Yes. I love that example. Yep. Can I quickly ask you, what is your experience with intuitive eating and exercise, either with your clients or personally?
Totally. In terms of intuitive eating and exercise, I'm happy to share personally. So where to even begin with this? I grew up a gymnast. It's funny. So I don't think you know this about me. I struggled with bulimia on and off for a very good majority of my life, about 16 years. And I was very averse to competitive sports, like team sports and just competition in general, and very, very focused on self-competition. And that's kind of where I picked up on just having, you know, gone through my own eating disorder and recovery, and also the aversion that I experienced through that team competition. And, it's just really interesting, but I grew up a gymnast. I also, swam in middle school and in high school, and, I did acting and was just in a lot of aesthetic type of sports and activities growing up, right? Where it was more like your body on display. But you know, I also had a really intuitive relationship with movement growing up before I actually was in my eating disorder. And I was really using movement to manipulate some of those behaviors. I grew up riding bikes all the time and playing in the yard and running around and playing tag and just swimming in the pool for fun, all the time, and jumping on trampolines at our neighbors' houses and, going on hikes. We had a family cabin up in North Carolina. I grew up in Florida, and just going on hikes with our family when we did that. And I remember we would always take walks as a family after dinner and just talk about the day. And that was just a really nice connection piece. And so growing up, like even in my eating disorder, it was more intuitive, my relationship with movement. Like I actually didn't make the association with rigid movement and disordered eating behaviors until later in my life, which is actually kind of interesting. I think I was, you know, manipulating in some ways, but in terms of the mental space that I was putting on that earlier in my life, it was not nearly as much. And then I did get into really rigid behaviors around food and developed exercise bulimia. And it became kind of like this gym culture situation and very, very, rigid running schedule and just running like far longer than my body needed to, particularly after binging, and just this tumultuous, very non-intuitive relationship with exercise. And it was really, you know, my body was like a bank account at that point. It was really what I was eating, how I was moving. It was very XYZ, and I hate math. so it felt, I mean, there was no joy at all. I was moving purely for aesthetics. And as I started healing my relationship with food, like much later in my journey, I took a break from movement, and I slowed down. I stopped running. I stopped like in just intense exercising, and I started doing yoga, which felt really good. And it really, like, it was the first time I hadn't done yoga really. I had never had like an active yoga practice, and I just remember getting on the mat and thinking, oh my God, I feel like I'm 6 years old in a gymnastics class. Like this is so fun and so playful. And it also was kind of interesting because I think the yoga culture can be very disordered as well too. And I was still very much in disordered eating and looking at the mirrors and just the aesthetics with that and everything. I also had to go through my own healing process with that as well too. And you know, I was just telling a client last night, we were talking about movement. I haven't done yoga like at all in the pandemic. And so now I'm at this place where I did a pose yesterday and I was like, wow, like my body can't do what it used to be able to do. And that's really interesting. And so just sitting with that, but yeah, I would say now I love to move in general. I get a lot of joy in being outside, whether that's just sitting or walking. But I do I do really appreciate how movement fits into my life now. I take walks in our neighborhood and don't do yoga right now. My husband and I love to just explore, whether it's going on a walk in another neighborhood or going on a hike somewhere around here. And, you know, just there's so much beauty in this world. And I love that aspect of movement, just being able to see it. So that's kind of, thanks for asking that question. I don't think I've ever talked about that before.
Thanks for answering.
Yeah. Movement is definitely one of those pieces of our relationship with ourselves that I think ebbs and flows throughout life. And, I've certainly gone through my own journey with just finding movement that works for me. And probably one of the biggest struggles is just giving myself that permission to rest, like through true healing, just being able to just be and not do. And that's kind of been like the latest chapter, like within the past year or two, of just sitting in that discomfort of not doing anything and just giving myself that full permission to just like sit and be and not move at all, you know?
Yes. Yes.
Well, Stephanie, this has just been so lovely, this whole conversation. I so appreciate everything that you shared and your truth and your expertise and just everything that you brought to this talk today. Where can everybody find you and connect with you?
I'm mostly on Instagram at Embodied Psychotherapist. I have a small group practice in Manhattan. We're still virtual, but Intuitive Psychotherapy NYC. Those are the two main places. So on my website, or which is linked in my Instagram.
Great. We'll link it all in the show notes. You're fabulous. Thank you for the work that you do and just what you bring to this world and your time today. This was
thank you. Time. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's our show. Thank you to our producer, Stephanie Olea, our show manager, Shayla Anderson, and our incredible guest. If you want to stay connected and learn more about our guest today, click the show notes of this episode. And if this conversation resonated with you, please share it with a friend or leave a review so that we can continue to destigmatize these important conversations around our relationship with food and body and spread inspiration to more women. One last thing, please don't forget to hit subscribe so that you can save time and stay on top of each new episode every week. I'm sending you so much love, confidence, and strength. Talk to you soon.